Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
First, let's get conspiratorial. This election year has been rife with political conspiracy theories, from Hillary Clinton supposedly funding Donald Trump's campaign to President Obama's birth status, again. Our country has a long history of conspiracy theories wending their way into popular culture and politics. Remember when the moon landing was staged by Hollywood? Area 51? Is our national fascination with conspiracy theories driven by a democratic notion of free speech that gives equal weight to ideas, or are there kernels of truth that lend credibility to otherwise bogus notions? We want to hear from you this hour. What conspiracy theories have you heard which have intrigued, angered, or stopped you in your tracks? What theories have resulted either in disbelief or maybe stopped you because they make a little sense? Call us at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828, or you can go to our live blog, nprnews.org/live. Joining us to help explain the long and inglorious history of conspiracy theories is Joe Yusinski. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami. He's also co-author of American Conspiracy Theories, published by the Oxford University Press. The book examines the history of conspiracy theories in the U.S. and reports back on extensive research he and his co-author, Joseph Parent, have done in the area. He joins us from Miami. We are also joined via Skype by Darren Samuelson. He is a senior reporter with Politico. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me.
Darren, if I could start with you. As you go about your daily job at Politico, what are you hearing in terms of conspiracy theories, novel conspiracy theories this year?
It really has been unlike any presidential campaign I've ever covered, and I've been doing this since the 2000 election. This campaign with the two candidates themselves, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, have histories around conspiracy theories that really stretch throughout their political careers. And so you bring these two candidates front and center as general election nominees for their two respective parties in an era really where people are consuming media that they believe in, as opposed to sort of the mainstream media that I grew up with, the three networks and the major newspapers in your hometown. You really get a ripe atmosphere. So everything from Hillary, and her health and every single aspect of how she is doing right now, to repeat them is maybe part of the problem here. But she's got a lot of ailments if you surf the internet, to the way this election is going to be played out here in November. We were consumed by whether President Obama was born in America even, just a couple of days ago. So it has just been one conspiracy theory after another. And what's maybe most amazing is it has driven, the discussion among the candidates and the media in a way that, again, I've never really seen as I've covered presidential campaigns.
So Joseph Yusinski, let me turn to you. We should have a definition maybe. How do you define a conspiracy theory?
Well, a conspiracy theory is a theory of events or circumstances that cites as a main causal factor a small group of people, the conspirators, working in secret for their own benefit and against the common good, and usually that theory will run afoul when compared to more authoritative accounts of those same events and circumstances. So whereas Watergate and Iran-Contra are conspiracies, because they really happened, the idea that JFK was killed by the CIA or the Mafia or Castro is a conspiracy theory.
So why are they so prevalent here? Where do they come from and what need do they fill?
Well, they fill a lot of needs. And one is that, the people who tend to use them the most are people who are on the outside, either people who have less power, people who aren't in the dominant group, people who don't have expertise or who aren't part of the authoritative establishment. Those people use these theories to point out danger, to say, hey, there's something going on here that we don't like. We need to come together. We need to watch out for that danger, and we need to act against it. So oftentimes what you see in conspiracy theories, it's not so much about the detail of the particular conspiracy theory, but it's about who's using it and why they're using it.
Interesting.
It's very much a reaction to power. I mean, if you go back to the George W. Bush years, nobody cared about the birth certificate. People cared about Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and Halliburton and Blackwater and war for oil and all of those conspiracy theories about Republicans because they were the party in power. As soon as they left office, no one cared about who did 9/11. It became socially inert. Now we cared about the fake birth certificate, and Obama blew up the Deepwater Horizon well, and he killed the kids at Sandy Hook. So what we find is this alternating pattern where whoever's in power are the ones who get the brunt of the accusations thrown at them.
So, Darren Samuelson, as you're doing your work at Politico, does that jibe with what you see happening out there?
Yeah, I mean, it brings back memories as well from 2004. If you remember, there was one of the debates, I think it was the first debate, where, everyone was saying that George W. Bush was wearing a microphone and saw, you know, the pictures on the back of his jacket. They would see this square outline, and the internet, you know, at the time was aflutter with, was George W. Bush getting his answers piped into his ear? And that is exactly the exact same conspiracy theory that is flying around the internet right now with respect to Hillary Clinton. When she's on the stage, people have been zooming in as close as possible to her ear during her debate performance, and as well a couple of weeks ago when she was on the stage with Matt Lauer saying, oh my God, she's wearing an earpiece. She's getting her answers piped into her. So fascinating how, you know, again, your position of power does totally equate to who is making the claims. And as well, here in the primaries, Bernie Sanders saying over and over again, you know, the rigged line that you hear now from Donald Trump, you would hear that from Bernie Sanders in a different context, per se, talking about the system being rigged and the Wall Street system. And also, of course, you know, having being reinforced by the leaked emails that came out here that show that indeed the Democrats were putting a little bit of a thumb on the scale to help Hillary Clinton win the nomination. So sometimes, as Joe was saying, a conspiracy theory, kind of moves into the norm on occasion. It can move into the norm once evidence starts to prove otherwise.
So, Joe, going in your book, you seem to indicate that the conspiracy theories have been just a huge part of American political life, really, since the founding of the Republic. I mean, going back to, I believe, the Declaration of Independence. I mean, why are they so prevalent here in the U.S.? Is it any worse than any other country?
It's tough to know if we're worse than any other country because we don't have those studies that look, you know, across nations to do those sorts of comparisons to know is the U.S. more or less than some other places. What I can say is that when you move into different institutional contexts, when you move into a country that has, you know, corrupt institutions, in those places you're probably better off believing in the conspiracy theory than you are in the authoritative account, because the conspiracy theory is probably more likely to be true. But in the U.S. we have, you know, very good institutions. They're not right all the time. They do make mistakes, and sometimes they do fall into bouts of corruption. But for the most part, our knowledge-generating institutions are pretty good. But if you go back in time through this country, what you find is that conspiracy theories are just a part of the human experience. Even before the founding of the country, you had the Salem witch trials, in which you had people believing women were conspiring with Satan. And then you move into the Declaration of Independence, and then you have this beautiful, the first few paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, just gorgeous prose, like the best political stuff ever written. And then you get beyond that, and it's just a bunch of conspiracy accusations against the king, which for the most part weren't even true. You fast forward, you have fears about the Freemasons, the Illuminati, the Red Scare. So you have these, you know, you have these fears that are always there, no matter what period of American history you look at. Now, for the most part, what I find in my research is that, you know, people are less conspiratorial over time. Is that people are, you know, we like to point to the internet and say, oh my God, in the age of the internet, it must be the case that people are, you know, sulking around in the dark corners of the internet and coming up with all these weird conspiracy theories. And because of social media, they could spread them so quickly. But the truth is, I think the internet does the opposite. And as much as you have the conspiracy theories on the internet, you also have the ability for a lot of people to eschew, you know, village wisdom and instead hear stuff right from authorities and experts in a way that you never had before. So that people now have access to the best information, too, because of the internet. And I think for that reason, conspiracy theorizing in the masses has gone down, even though, as Darren points out, this election is not like any other because our two most, you know, important elites right now, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, are taking part in it.
Our guests today are Joseph Yusinski, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami and co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. We're also joined via Skype by Darren Samuelson, a senior reporter at Politico. Now, we're also wanting to hear your favorite conspiracy theories. What have you heard recently? What about from the past? Call 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828, or you can go to our live blog, nprnews.org/live. We have Todd on the line from Roberts, Wisconsin. Todd?
Good morning.
What's your theory that you want to talk about?
Well, I've always heard from some other friends of mine about this group called the Bilderberg Group and how they are a group of very wealthy individuals around the world, and that they want to have a just like a one currency, and that they control a lot of things that happen here in the United States and the rest of the world as well. One would be the house market crash. I heard that they were behind getting Obama as president. Hillary was running, but they told her it wasn't her time yet. She will be the next president. And they control the banks. And I was just curious, is there any weight to something like that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Gentlemen?
Go ahead, Joe.
I guess I'll do
stunned silence,
I'll jump
yes.
In first. There are a lot of conspiracy theories like this where people point to some all-powerful group that controls seemingly everything and has designs on having even more power in the future. You know, as far as I can tell, there isn't much evidence to support any of this. Yes, there are people who meet in the Bilderberg and other hotels to talk about current events, and yes, some of them are rich and powerful. You know, but rich and powerful people hang out with rich and powerful people. You know, there's social sorting that goes on. So that's why you tend to have these networks that are somewhat class-based. And if anyone could point to, you know, we have the transcript from their meeting where they say they're going to do A, B, and C, and then A, B, and C happens, you know, I'll be happy to believe it. But, you know, the evidence that's been provided so far doesn't suggest that the Bilderbergers are really doing or controlling all that much. And they're not dissimilar from fears, you know, 200 years ago about the Illuminati or 150 years ago about the Freemasons during the middle of last century when people were concerned about the communists controlling everything or the UN controlling everything.
It actually reminds me of a discussion I once heard about the origins of the James Bond stories, in that part of the interest that people have is not, I mean, there's the character, obviously, but it's actually the thrill that there might be these evil corporations in the shadows trying to control us, and that, in fact, goes back to almost biblical ideas about a malevolent deity looking down and causing havoc. I mean, I suppose it's kind of natural, the whole thing.
Well, one thing I would say is that, you know, there are bad people out there who want to do bad things. And in a democracy, people are called upon to be very vigilant. So that's a role that conspiracy theorists sometimes have to play, because the media won't always do that job well, right? And there are plenty of examples through history of real conspiracies happening. It's just one thing people should think about when they evaluate a conspiracy theory is that the more people that you have involved in something, the more likely it is to fail, because somebody's going to screw up or somebody's going to let the cat out of the bag, per se. So if we're talking about, oh, there's this conspiracy that's been going on with the Bilderbergers for decades now, and they have massive plans to take over the planet, well, think about how many people they have to have involved in something like that, and that nobody's talked at this point.
Maybe following up on that point, we have Joy in Cannon Falls. Joy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks. This is pretty fortuitous. I was reading in the Washington Post this weekend. I don't know if any of you saw it, but there was quite a profile of a woman named Melanie Austin in the Washington Post this weekend, and they were talking about her experience. She was actually arrested by the police earlier this spring because she posted that she wanted to have Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama hung. And down further in the article, she was talking about how what she posted was very similar to what a member of Congress posted, and she was wondering why she was, arrested and he wasn't. But it detailed all of the conspiracy theories that she believes in. And these are ones that, if you're on social media or getting emails from your, crazy uncle out in California, you've heard all of these different conspiracies before. It's all the birther stuff. It's all the, Obama wasn't born here and all of that. And, what I found is that it's really difficult to get people to disbelieve this stuff, even if you point them towards Snopes, or any of the sites that would be more of a fact-checking organization, they really don't want to believe it. I'll push back every single time, and they get that over and over from their social groups, and they're not willing to believe fact checkers. That's all just part of the conspiracy. So I agree somewhat with your guests that, there's a lot more information, and you can get the facts on the internet, but you can get a whole lot of other things if you want to believe it.
Well, Darren, Joe, are people in just an echo chamber when it comes to this stuff sometimes?
Yeah, I would agree with your caller. That Washington Post story that was written this weekend by Stephanie McCrumman was a great, great story, really taking you into one person's perspective, but really kind of illuminating everything that we are talking about here. And I would have to say that, that story hits on a point. I mean, the Trump supporters are definitely, more likely to believe, for example, that this election is not going to go their way and that there's something, more nefarious happening here. You are seeing that in repeated polls at this moment that, what Donald Trump has been saying about the fact that the election is going to be rigged in swing states. It sets up a very interesting proposition down the line if indeed the election goes down in November and there's a contested event, if there's more than hanging chads, if there's, a cyber attack or even something questionable that happens in a couple of swing counties, you could get into a situation where Donald Trump perhaps doesn't concede or Hillary Clinton doesn't concede, and you really reach a threshold moment in American history where, typically if you lose the election, you do agree that the person that beat you, is the winner. We didn't see Al Gore protest beyond the Supreme Court decision. Richard Nixon ultimately accepted John F. Kennedy as president. So, the Trump phenomenon is one that makes this sort of very real in a sense. And the other point I would point out, as the caller mentioned, is we are seeing anecdotally at least the Facebook unfriending phenomenon. I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago in Politico, really taking off. There's no data yet that Facebook is willing to share. They're not saying they don't have the data on how many people are clicking, whether it be the unfriend button or the button to turn off feeds coming from other people. But you are hearing over and over people saying, hey, please unfriend me if you are voting for Hillary or if you're voting for Trump. And that does winnow out, what kind of information you're going to see on your page. And then, vice versa, if you are supporting one or the other, You know, if you have Donald Trump supporters in your Facebook feed, you're going to get a lot of information from people, you know, articles that are posted on the internet that aren't necessarily true or even real legitimate news sites, saying things, you know, that are completely false or conspiracy theories about Hillary Clinton that are written, that are purported to be, you know, real news when in fact they're not. And it is really forcing journalists, you know, to do their jobs in a totally different way right now. Compared to how we even had to handle the 2012 election with respect to, you know, the fake news sites that are out there and the conspiracy theories that are making their way onto the internet in ways that, you know, you try and put out one fire, but there are 100 more right behind it.
Darren Simonson is a senior reporter with Politico. We're also joined by Joe Yasinski, the author of American Conspiracy Theories. And Joe, you actually have a chapter in your book which says it's called Conspiracy Theories Are for Losers, which is perhaps not as pejorative as it might seem immediately, but you have a point to make on this.
Yeah, and again, I don't mean that as a pejorative. I mean it as a descriptive. You know, when we look over time, the people who are engaging in the most conspiracy theorizing at any given point are the people who are on the outside of power. And you, in this country, the presidency is the biggest symbol of power. So what we found looking over the course of the last 120 years was that, you know, whoever the president was, it was their party and the groups associated with their party that had all of the conspiracy accusations hurled at them from the people who were in the opposite party. So what that tells you about conspiracy theories is that they're for people on the outside. They're for people who are either out of power, they're not in the dominant group. And this applies to many different conspiracy theories. So think about climate change. You know, when the climate scientists are in 98% agreement that climate change is real, man-made, and happening, you know, the people on the outside of that, the non-climate scientists and the people who want to argue against climate change, they're on the outside. They can't argue that they have better science. They can't argue that they have better scientists. All they can argue is it must be a conspiracy, that the scientists and the communists are involved in, you know, in something together. So that's what we see with most conspiracy theories that catch on, is that they're concocted and spread and believed in by people who don't have any other means than to use that. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing. But when you see big conspiracy theories, that tends to be where they're coming from.
We have a lot of people who have been calling in. A lot of people have been sending us things online. Stephanie Curtis joins us. What do you have on the page?
So Tim wrote on nprnews.org/live. He says, most conspiracy theories by turns are annoying or amusing. However, one category is just plain sad. The crisis actor theories that say certain events never really happened. Sandy Hook staged, Aurora a hoax, Pulse nightclub a fake intended to divert us. And Brian says, the one that I hear often in Cook County, Minnesota, is that Wellstone's plane was shot down by President Bush so Republicans could win control of the Senate.
We have Richard in Minneapolis called in to say that the Virginia shooting being fake is a theory that had stopped him in his tracks. Noah in Minneapolis says he's been hearing a lot of people talking about the flat earth theory. He thinks it's ridiculous that it's coming back, but he's noticed that many people are buying in. And then Bob in St. Paul asks our guests about conspiracy theories actually being put forward by people in power. I mean, is this a control thing in some ways, like the Red Scare?
Well, one thing that frightens me with conspiracy theories is when powerful people use them, because that's when I think they become armed. When people who don't have a lot of power use them, it doesn't bother me that much. If somebody accuses President Obama of having faked his birth certificate, I don't really care, because the president is one of the most well-protected people on the planet. And we should be criticizing him, maybe not necessarily for that, but presidents are designed to be criticized. They are somewhat insulated from it. But when you have powerful people pointing the finger at the most vulnerable among us, so if you have a President Trump pointing his finger at political refugees and undocumented immigrants, I mean, those are the most vulnerable people that we have here. And for someone like that to point their finger at them puts them in a very precarious situation. And even if he doesn't act against them the way that he says he wants to, other people may act on his expectations. Other people may take action into their own hands. So that's where I think it becomes very dangerous.
It can become almost a method of control, though. I mean, going back to the Red Scare in the 50s, the conspiracy theories that were floating around there, and certainly there probably were socialists in certain parts of the government, but in no way did it really require the reaction which was produced.
No, and what we saw there was a mass violation of rights because you had Congress throwing these accusations around as if they were nothing, and they were destroying people's lives. I mean, put it into a different institutional context. I mean, look at how Mao used conspiracy theories, how Stalin, how Hitler have used them, how North Korea uses them to keep themselves isolated. So you take out, you know, our separation of powers and our federalism and how well our institutions work in this country, you put it into a different context where a powerful person can use conspiracy theories for whatever reason they want, you can wind up with some very bad outcomes.
I wanted to quickly go to Paul, who's calling in from La Crosse. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
You have a tool.
I think it's Snoops or Snopes.com. And for checking out all the conspiracies that I hear about. And I think they do a very good job, except that the people who came up with the conspiracies in the first place then say, well, they're in on it. And that's why they discredited their particular, you know. So I was just wondering, how many times a day do you go to this website, or do you have any others that work for you?
Good question.
Well, I go to Snopes. Snopes is definitely one of the useful sites that's out there to debunk whether it be a conspiracy theory or something that is inaccurately being said on the presidential campaign trail, where I spend my days right now. Politico, where I work, does fact check. We tend to go hardcore at the debates when maybe information is flying at a pretty rapid speed. So we have posted something called the Wrongometer. That's been running through every single one of the Republican and Democratic primary debates. And then we had 12 people in a room on last week during the first presidential debate. We'll be at it again tomorrow night for the VP debate, and then again through the final two. And so, you know, that is a situation where basically we're listening. You know, everyone has an expertise, a subject matter expertise in that room. And as we hear something that is said, we quickly go to work and figure out if it's right or not right, and knock it down if it is wrong, or we'll hold it up if it's correct. And then, you know, there are a number of other websites, from the Washington Post to PolitiFact, that are doing a very good job here this cycle. There is a point, though, I think Joe's made it as well many times, that you know, people don't necessarily seek out the fact checks when they're really looking to get their information debunked. I think people who believe in conspiracy theories are not necessarily going to go to Politico or to Snopes to necessarily have their opinions changed. So people tend to end up in their silos and can't have their views changed. It's kind of like if you're sitting at the Thanksgiving table and you've got the uncle at the end of the table who, you know, believes that Barack Obama is not born in America. There's really nothing you're going to be able to say there to prove otherwise. And nowadays, I mean, to come back to what Joe was saying earlier as well about the internet, I mean, these articles, the fake stuff that is out there is up there forever, and it is really difficult once it's up there to take it down. So someone always has an ability to point back to the source that they saw on the internet. I believe Rudy Giuliani even said earlier this presidential cycle, maybe in the last couple of weeks, I read it on the internet with respect to one of the conspiracy theories that wasn't proven. So, you know, the fact that it's actually made it to that point on the campaign trail, that you have one of the leading surrogates for one of the candidates, you know, telling people to just go to the internet and Google about Hillary Clinton's health, that says something about where we are in American discourse right now. A dangerous place, I think.
Darren Samuelson is a senior reporter with Politico. We're also joined by Joe Yusinski, who is an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami. He wrote American Conspiracy Theories, published by Oxford University Press, which examines the history of conspiracy theories in the U.S. and also has extensive research, which I hope that we'll get into immediately after the news here. But remember, you can call in 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2000. 2828, or you can go to our live blog, nprnews.org/live, to give us your thoughts or your favorite conspiracy theories. But let us go to Phil Picardi with the latest news.
Good morning, Ewan. Donald Trump's supporters continue to be aggressively defiant in response to a New York Times story that says Trump may not have paid federal income taxes for nearly two decades. Former Congressman Jack Kingston says he's confident Trump followed the law. He says the story said Trump's losses in 1995 were big enough that he could have legally avoided paying taxes for as long as 18 years. He accuses the Times of a partisan agenda. Hillary Clinton visits Ohio today. It will be her first appearance in the battleground state in a month. A senior government official in Jamaica says people in flood-prone areas of that country are refusing to leave their homes as the outer bands of Hurricane Matthew bring heavy rain and some flooding parts to parts of the island. The center of the storm is expected to pass to the east of Jamaica tomorrow. Already, many streets have flooded in low-lying areas. Police say there have been no casualties reported, but two men were arrested for looting in Kingston. Matthew is also expected to impact Haiti and Cuba. Officials say militants have carried out a series of attacks in Shiite-majority neighborhoods in Baghdad, killing at least 15 civilians. A police officer says the deadliest attack took place in a southwestern neighborhood when a bomber set off his explosive vest in a busy outdoor market, killing seven shoppers and wounding up to 25 other people. And outdoor gear giants Bass Pro and Cabela's will combine in a $4.5 billion deal. It creates uncertainty about jobs in Cabela's home state of Nebraska. Bass Pro CEO Johnny Morris says he hopes to continue growing the Cabela's brand alongside his own Missouri-based chain. Both chains have stores in Minnesota. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:38.
One of these men will be a heartbeat away from the Oval Office.
People in both parties are restless for change.
America looks in the mirror, and what is it that we see there?
Mike Pence, Tim Kaine. Where do the vice presidential nominees stand on the issues? Find out Tuesday when they go head-to-head in their one and only debate. I'm Robert Siegel. Join me for live coverage and real-time fact-checking from NPR News.
And, of course, you can hear the vice presidential debate live here Tuesday, tomorrow evening at 8 on NPR News. Going back to our discussion about conspiracy theories, we've got a lot of people calling in, we've got a lot of people online, and of course we have our guest, Joseph Yusinski, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami, and Darren Samuelson, Senior Reporter at Politico. Now, Joe, you spent a lot of time actually looking into the social science of conspiracy theories. It's such a huge topic. How did you even begin to try and research this?
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't easy because when we got into it 6 or 7 years ago, there wasn't a lot of good data out there on who believed in what and why. So the question we wanted to answer was, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? And what we found was that there were some polls, you know, about who believed that JFK was killed in a conspiracy theory, or in recent years, who believed that 9/11 was a conspiracy or the birth certificate was faked. But other than that, there wasn't that much out there. So we went back to the New York Times and looked at their letters to the editor over 120 years, and we pulled out a sample of 1,000 for every year. So we wound up with about 120,000 letters. And we read them all, and we picked out the ones that talked about conspiracy theories.
You personally read them all?
Well, when I say me, I mean my graduate assistants. So. And they, trust me, they believe they were conspired against by me, so for making them do that. But we read 120,000 of them, and we picked out the ones that talked about a conspiracy theory. And what we found was that there are so many different conspiracy theories out there. It's not just the big ones like JFK or the Freemasons or the Bilderbergers or the Birther and Truther. There are, you know, millions of them. There's just a great diversity out there of conspiracy theories.
I just picked out a few here. I mean, the one that pointed out there's a law protecting sheep, which was really a government plot to allow the eradication of dogs.
Yeah, so back in the 1920s, there was somebody who was worried that Congress was going to try and kill all the pet dogs. You know, in the 1960s, somebody believed that lesbianism was a plot created by the CIA. So there are all sorts of different ones out there, and we tend to only hear about, you know, the big ones, the ones that catch, you know, the eye of a significant amount of people. But there are so many that come and go in the night that somebody will come up with, maybe a few people will buy into it, but it will just wash away quickly over time.
I particularly like the one that Mozart's music is socialistic and is being used to poison the minds of the youth of America, which I immediately saw, yeah, of course.
Well, if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, what you will find is almost everything was thought to be part of a communist plot. So whether it was the Beatles, whether it was Sunday morning TV, it was all there to brainwash our kids.
Indeed. Let's we got a call from Elizabeth in Minnetonka, and she wonders, are there times when there should be conspiracy theories? If, for instance, Trump has very interesting opinions on Russia and he's hiding his tax returns, she wonders if a conspiracy theory of him funding Russian banks could create an investigation that would be helpful. I mean, are there times when conspiracy theories have proved to be right?
Absolutely. And one example I'll give you is two cheeky journalists at the Washington Post who followed a conspiracy theory which eventually brought down a sitting president.
I vaguely remember that one, yes.
Yeah. So it's not that they're all false, right? It's that they run counter to what we believe at a particular time, and with proper evidence could eventually be thought to be true. So conspiracy theorists do a good thing, and sometimes even if they are wrong, they will often bring to light new evidence that might not have found the light of day before. I mean, JFK makes a great example of that. When the Warren Report came out, it was these huge volumes. They weren't indexed, and back then there was no searchable text. So a bunch of conspiracy theorists got together and they indexed them so that people could find what was where in those giant volumes. And you also had conspiracy theorists pushing for the release of more documents. So after the Oliver Stone movie comes out, you have a new commission set up to release more documents. So because of that, we know more now than we did before. And in that sense, conspiracy theorists actually did us a service.
We have Jenna in Minneapolis on the line. Good morning, Jenna. You have a question?
Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a little about how conspiracy theories about, like, marginalized groups can, you know, actually cause harm. I've heard from, like, Muslim friends things like of being used by people of, like, practicing, like, something called taqiyya, where all Muslims are, like, encouraged to try to and deceive non-Muslims and things like that. So it creates like this kind of circular conspiracy theory because you can never prove it right or wrong. So, or that LGBTQ people are pushing some type of agenda or something like that. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you. So I suppose we're getting back to that idea of power, trying to control.
Yeah, it's not very good to see conspiracy theories being used by powerful people because they can back up their accusations with force, right? And we saw this in Nazi Germany where Hitler said the Jews were, you know, both communists and capitalists. Obviously, they can't be both. You know, he got the whole nation behind them, and it led to very, you know, very bad things, obviously.
Right.
And you don't want to see that in this context. Obviously, it's, you know, the U.S. is very different than, you know, the Nazi Germany or Mao China or Stalin's Russia. But when you have power backing up these sorts of fears, it leads to bad stuff.
I think what Jenna is talking about, though, is this going on through the general population, mm-hmm. and then maybe being echoed by people in power, but just this rumbling in the background that throughout society.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily good either. My hope is that if people are fearful of each other, they would do their best to overcome those fears. But, you know, every group... You know, it pains me to say this, but every group has fears about every other group to some extent. You know, back in the 1950s, there were these polls that asked people, you know, what do you think about communists? Would you want them to, you know, work in a public school or live in your neighborhood? And people were overwhelmingly like, no way, get them out of here. So they wanted, you know, people's rights to be violated. And then by the 1970s, they re-asked that question and they asked people about communists. And people, you know, no longer cared that much about communists. But they said, you know, is it the case that people are more tolerant or is it that they just dislike other groups? So they re-asked the question and said, you know, what groups do you dislike? And people were more than happy to list a few. And they said, would you be happy to violate their rights? And everyone said, sure. So there's a lot of people out there who, if you name the right group for them, they will be more than happy to take away their free speech or their due process or not allow them to hold certain jobs.
Our guests today are Joseph Yusinski, who is at the University of Miami, and Darian Samuelson, who is with Politico. We have Eric in Canby on the line, and I was wondering if someone would want to discuss this. Eric?
Yes.
You have some thoughts.
I do. And let me just preface it by saying I think conspiracy theories sometimes are just born out of hatred. And people looking for reasons to to continue hating another group or party or person. And then there's another type of conspiracy theory, and I think that's, you know, born out of people not feeling like they're getting the full dope. They're not getting the information. And for me, that later is always kind of circled around September 11th and the World Trade Center attacks. And I know it's a touchy subject. I'm certainly not looking for anyone on the program to confirm a theory or otherwise. But, you know, I'm not an engineer. I'm not an architect. But there seems to be a general consensus within some groups that the World Trade Center buildings were brought down in controlled demolition. And I think, again, that's kind of born out of not getting all of the information about that day from the governing powers and otherwise. And I guess I just kind of wanted to hear what you guys who deal specifically with, in conspiracy theories, maybe what you guys see and hear and things that are interesting and things that can be pushed to the side. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll pick up my response on the radio.
Thank you. Thanks for calling, Eric. Gentlemen?
Joe, I'm going to let you take 9/11.
Okay.
Okay. Well, interesting thing is I was there for it, and I'll just recount it very briefly a story. I woke up in the morning, and I turned on the TV in Midtown Manhattan, and I saw the two planes had hit the building, and we didn't know what kind of planes they were at that point. It was still very early in the morning. So I decided to walk down towards it, and by mid-afternoon, they had deployed the National Guard, and there was, you know, people with machine guns on every corner of every intersection. And I picked up a cheap camera and started snapping some photos. And one of the military people with, you know, who was heavily armed, saw me with the camera and said, no pictures allowed. So I took a picture and ran. And I thought about this after the fact. You know, was that person trying to hide something? Were they on orders to stop people from taking pictures of what was going on because they were trying to, you know, hide the truth of the event? Or was it just a guy who just had the heck scared out of him, didn't know what was going on, had no control over a very uncertain situation, and was trying to get some control over what was going on in a very chaotic moment? I guess I'll never know the truth to that. I have the picture. I guess I could track down the guy if I wanted to. But there are different ways to interpret that, right? Somebody might say, oh my gosh, it proves there was a conspiracy. And other people might say, it just proves how awful an event it was.
I suppose, I mean, it's one of the most photographed events in recent history. To see, to have someone make that declaration is just seems a little odd. But I can see how it could be interpreted in many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, if the government was trying to hide pictures of 9/11, they've done a god-awful job of it. So I don't see that their plan of covering up really worked. Because there are, I mean, even to this day, there are videos and pictures coming out of it. So I highly doubt that that was a plot to keep me from uncovering the truth.
We have more people on the line. Andy in Rochester. Hello,
well,
Andy.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I am wondering if you consider it a conspiracy in the sense you're talking about there, that only Democrats and Republicans are on these debates on television, and I think that it's former leaders of those parties that are making the decision on this commission of theirs. Is that true?
Well, the Presidential Commission for Debates does have a threshold percentage number that you need to be polling at in order to land on the stage with the major party nominees, and neither Gary Johnson nor Jill Stein has come close to crossing that threshold. I think Gary Johnson at one point was within striking distance, but he didn't quite get there. We haven't seen a third party or even an independent since Ross Perot on that stage. I know a lot of people wanted Ralph Nader, for example, in 2000 to be on that stage, but again, you need to be polling at a certain place, and there are rules that are put in place early on to make that happen. So I think it's as simple as that. And you know, again, if for a third party nominee, you need to be you need to have some level of support in order to be seen as worthwhile up on that stage.
You know, the third parties in this country never win. So when I say conspiracy theories are for losers, you know, one of the things we found in the book was that people who belong to a third party tend to be incredibly conspiratorial in their mindset. And it makes perfect sense because they never win. They're always on the outside. So not only do they not have any institutional power, they really don't have any party power. And they're essentially kept out of the dialogue in the country. So I understand the sentiment of people who support third-party candidates, because it has to feel to them like there must be a conspiracy to keep their ideas out.
Could I bring up one quick point about 9/11 that was discussed before, and sort of brings a lot of this back together again? One thing that's happening in American politics right now is people are feeling like they can talk about conspiracy theories as elected officials in a way that's not going to get them in trouble, in a way that maybe a couple of years ago maybe that wasn't the case. I'm thinking of Van Jones, who is now on CNN, a very well-known commentator, and he got he was a White House official in the Obama first term who ended up losing his job in part because he had signed a 9/11 truther document. The Obama White House booted him out. He was also caught on tape calling Republicans a pretty disparaging term during the sort of Tea Party movement. So you sort of had, you know, within his own party or within his own administration sort of casting him out and saying, sorry, you know, you need to go find another job. And, you know, we haven't really seen that to a large extent with Donald Trump. You haven't really seen Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and others, you know, repudiate Donald Trump for every single conspiracy theory that that he has put out there in this cycle, which I think has maybe reinforced the ability of people who are running for office to say the things that they're saying. Another thing is, you know, when someone says something that's a little bit outlandish, whether it be on the House floor, someone like an Alan Grayson, a congressman from Florida, about the Republican health care plan, he was saying that it's something that helps them die. You know, it would be that's the Republican plan, was to help people die quickly. He ended up making a heck of a lot of money fundraising. So there is this ability to do quite well when you start to talk about conspiracy theories out you know, on a Senate or House floor. Rand Paul as well, talking about drone strikes in America, held a filibuster for hours and hours, and you know, helped him catapult his short-lived Republican presidential campaign. But nonetheless, people are feeling more comfortable running for office, talking about these and not being repudiated in a way that necessarily they were before.
We have a lot of people on the line, a lot of people who have been writing in online. Stephanie?
Yeah. Esther drives her teenagers crazy by pretending to believe in the flat earth theory and that the earth is surrounded by ice. Patrick is driven crazy by his mother. His mother thinks that Greenpeace is a front for Illuminati death camps. And Tom has kind of a meta conspiracy theory. Tom says, some of the Trump supporters and those in the alt-right knowingly promote conspiracies that they don't believe to disrupt and challenge the belief system of others.
Interesting. We actually have someone who called in earlier who, and this is kind of an interesting point. It says, she says her husband is very much into conspiracy theories, It's changed him as a person. It feels like she's married to a stranger now. Wonders what happened, if this has happened to other people. She doesn't believe in them, but he does. It's made life hard to be with someone who doesn't believe in doctors. Is this, can it be a problem?
I don't want to give out marital advice on air, so that's...
Fair enough.
I'm not that kind of doctor.
But these can overtake people's lives.
That's right. And, you know, one thing that we find is that people tend to self-sort in their relationships. We were talking about defriending people before on Facebook, but people tend to marry people who agree with them. You know, and sometimes you might marry someone and then 20 years down the road, you find out that you have nothing in common politically, and that can drive a wedge in the relationship. I don't know what you do about it at that point, because it's unlikely that the husband is going to, you know, believe anything that Snopes.com says. You know, particularly if it comes to medical conspiracy theories. I mean, people who believe in a lot of conspiracy theories about the medical establishment, they tend to behave differently when it comes to medical care than people who don't believe in those conspiracy theories. So that could, you know, very much drive a wedge in the marriage.
We have been talking about conspiracy theories and that there's so many of them floating around this particular election. But are we in an age of conspiracy theories, or have other times been much worse?
I would say that the people, you know, the mass public is not more conspiratorial in its thought than at any other time. I would say that because of Donald Trump, we have this phenomenon in our elite discourse right now. We have our two major candidates talking about conspiracy theories a lot. We have them accusing the other of conspiring, and we have a lot of news coverage of this. So our elite media and our two most important politicians right now are ensconced in this. And that's what makes this time different than any time before. Well, there's always been conspiracy theories in presidential elections, but now, because we have this outsider named Donald Trump, somebody who's essentially running against the entire establishment, and when you have to take down the establishment, you generally have to do it with conspiracy theories. It's the only way to say that the entire establishment is wrong. This is what you're going to get, is an election where it's just conspiracy accusation, just going back and forth at each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you have Hillary Clinton as well, with a history of, you know, claiming that there was a vast right-wing conspiracy trying to bring her and her husband down, you know, 20 years ago in the White House, and she now is back in the limelight, and all of the stuff from her husband's time in office is coming back up in a little drip, 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 you know, way, where Donald Trump and his surrogates keep wanting to talk about it, but maybe not directly talking about it. That makes it live. And then on top of that, you have, you know, we didn't really get into it, but the Russian hackers as well.
Oh, dear. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. Joseph Yusinski, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami, co-author of American Conspiracy Theories, and also via Skype, Darren Samuelson, Senior Reporter with Politico. Thank you for joining us.